Warning, this episode features Steve Herbeck. Tell the kids to go in the other room.
I can't get these muskies out of my mind. And some kind of madness has started to evolve.
Alright folks, welcome to the Muskie 360 Podcast, Jay Bird.
Steve!
I finally just took the gun out of my mouth. It warmed up. It has been
nice.
Ridiculous, okay. Dude. Just ridiculous. I've just had the 4 days from hell, not even gonna lie, of just the toughest conditions you can get at, Jay. It was horrible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of those deals where you love a giant, there's nothing better when it's sub-freezing, right? So it's sub-freezing. Then on top of it, it's flooded. So that was an exciting, whoo, nothing like a good old-fashioned kick in the face, but
kind of a 1-2 punch is what you're telling me.
Oh, just ridiculous. No, I'm not even ready to unpack how angry I was at those. You couldn't slow down enough. You can't. It was just literally like that. What you needed to do tactically, you couldn't do because it's like ripping current and it was whatever. But other than that, finally warmed up. Just literally, I'm covered in grease, Jay. Trailer breakage, folks. I was just telling Jay. You know you fish too much when you have 70,000 miles on a trailer. And it's only we're not talking, I've had this for very long. That's called going
to
fish.
It's not like it's rusting away.
Run compared to the truck mileage, because I always have my truck, always have a trailer on. I don't drive around doing anything else. It's not like I'm going, taking it off or anything. There's no point. And I couldn't believe that, Jay. I looked at it. I called the really nice people that make my trailer and, hey, this is broke. Oh, well, you didn't, you know, it's only been like a year, you know, or whatever. Actually, a hair more on that one because flipping over on the trailer, not the boat, but the trailer. And it's unbelievable. So, yes, I'm covered in grease. It's very exciting, Jay. I love it.
Yeah, it's a good day, huh?
When you are just, you know,
getting hands dirty,
just face deep in a trailer tongue actuator. What could be better? Really? I mean, who doesn't wake up and go, you know what I'd love? No, let's not go fishing or lay on the couch. Let's play with the trailer tongue actuator. But anyway,
yeah, let's fix that stuff in between trips.
Fixing stuff.
Life of a guide,
every
right?
Day. I've got a heck of a mechanic. He actually comes to the house, Jay. I don't even have to take it anywhere. How badass!
Oh, I thought you were going to say Jody Michael. No. Okay, someone different.
No, that's called a bread maker. I'm teasing. I love my list. I've got a couple really sexist jabs in here lately. Jay knows.
Okay.
Well, yeah. What was it? I said women shouldn't fish. The problem is I definitely don't. I don't rule the roost here. So those are all in jest. I would be beaten savagely. But no, it's just like you talk about doing things. It's just a side street there. But when you're running every day. Every day. It's nuts. I mean, I have this awesome marine mechanic. He comes, and I could do my own oil changes, but I'm lazy because of a time thing. It's like literally, dude's changing the oil in the back of the boat. It's time for the 100 hours for the millionth day. You know, it's like, oh my goodness. It's like you shut your eyes and open them. It's 100 hours, you know, and you're sitting there. He's doing that, and I'm getting, fixing this or fixing that just to be able to run. You know, and it's nuts how much it stacks up on you. You look at the wear and tear. I mean, I looked at my trolling motor and going through, you know, everything gets swapped out on an annual basis kind of schedule here with some of that stuff. And you go, this trolling motor looks like it's 4,000 years old. Like, it's nuts. But that's why
And it's a year old. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Oh boy!
But well, it's something that people don't realize. I use the All Trex because it's like the kind of the southern model, but I like it for up north because of really good boat control. I don't trust some servo motor. Blah 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 blah. You can wear the bushings out on that thing, literally where it deploys, right? So there's two deployment bushings on either side of it. Wore through those. So that tells you how much that thing's up and down. But it's just goofy. I'm just complaining, if brake actuators, Jay. It's like Love Actually, but brake actuators.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Everything. I mean, for the most part, if you talk about the amount of miles and hours on some of that equipment that is, holding up pretty good, right? I mean, the Mancota, for the most part.
Oh, there's that.
That's been a good motor. That's been solid.
That is not a complaint. If you want to know good equipment is going to last a year, right? But you're using it day after day after day. And when I say day after day, I'm not just going, I go three times a week, you know? No, how do you think the Musky Shop videos that are on the water get made? How do you think, all this stuff? So if I'm not guiding, which is a rarity, I'm out doing this other stuff, which actually I need to, we got something, after Magnus, we got something else coming up, which I need to go film. We need to talk about that game plan. We're just spitballing live on air here. The old planer boards, we'll talk about that. Just remind me. But if it'll last a year without just complete, breakdown, it's got a big double thumbs up for me.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And that's the thing. I'm not complaining about anything but I've been through the rigmarole. That's something, if you guys ever ask, we don't talk a lot about boat equipment on here, but you can't shoot an email or text, or not a text, please don't shoot it, send a text, but go to the Ask the Pro on the app and shoot something over. If you have a question about a product, I've probably used it or broken it, and I'd be happy to answer that, whether we do it on the podcast or not, because when it comes to even your mounting hardware for your fish finders, you've got a bunch of different variants, and some of the ones that are really popular are total garbage. it's like there's nothing worse. You pay $80 to $100 for a fish finder mount, and it's just garbage, But anyway, I beat the crap out of it. Speaking of beating the crap out of stuff, Jay.
What do you mean?
I don't know. I beat the crap out of the app yesterday. So I sat on the couch, and I had a master plan for this for months and didn't have the opportunity because of time, and did a kind of a reload on the Musky 360 app. So if you're using it every day, you're going to notice it's different on the front. If you haven't used it or you use it irregularly, kind of reloaded the app, just modernized it a little bit. It was just kind of time. And so when you check it out on the front, you're going to find a lot of cool new features and a lot of new visuals. So there's some easy access stuff on the front, and something I want to say about the app, right? And I looked, and obviously we're going to always feature the Musky Shop stuff, or as Booker put stuff out, but I think as far as the videos, the video section of the app, because you're going to have your front section, there's a home page now that's kind of an aggregate, but just so if you, hey, why aren't you putting this up or putting that out? I think my goal, there's so many good videos from a lot of different people that I'm going to spend the next little bit, kind of trimming down the video section on the app, because I don't care about watching somebody catch a fish. I want to make sure that every video on there covers a teachable moment, right?
There you go.
I think that's a way more valuable thing. So if there's any video you've seen, I'm not saying you, Jay, hey, check out, this guy guy, and he did a tutorial.
Yeah, that'd be great.
There's some of the stuff Chaz Martin, he's a bud or whatever you want to call him. I just saw he did some videos of some whiteboard stuff. We got some whiteboard stuff, and just kind of gear that to more teachable stuff, because anybody could just get on the YouTube and sit there and doom scroll. And the goal of the app's never been for it to be to doom scroll videos. So if you see some stuff where did that go? Where that, I'm going to kind of take the videos down to teaching, and I think it's way more valuable for when you're sitting there using the app. Get your fix of watching the same old musky stuff somewhere else. You know what I'm saying? Because that's what YouTube's for. But I think dialing that in a more teaching element there and kind of archiving that and try to clean up that, you know. But cool. I'm digging the way the app looks. Got some other features I'm working on. Hopefully very shortly, like I said, we'll see. I don't even want to say what it is, but there's going to be a couple new cool features on there. So, Jay, if you're listening on Tuesday, right? If you go forward 2 days, if you're listening on Tuesday, it would be 1 week from the Magnus. So,
yeah, it would be.
Yeah. March 4th.
Week away.
March 4th. March 4th. Get them. There's a banner. I'm looking on the front of the Muskie shop right now. It should have a seizure warning. So
it should.
Jay,
it's pretty flashy.
Is it GIF or JIF?
No, you're asking the wrong person.
I know what it. Well, it's a loaded question, but nonetheless, yeah, Magnus is coming out there. Nah, you know, you guys have heard it. I'm excited about it, but I'll stop beating you with it. We're not ever trying to beat you with it. Never. But those are coming. Planer boards very shortly. Jay, any comings and or goings that you've seen? Any grumblings?
Yeah, we've got that new product we can't talk about yet that is coming probably, what are we thinking, April? Late March, maybe?
What?
You got to get rolling on that. That new secret thing.
Oh, yeah.
Got that. Yeah, there's a few new baits coming.
That's not a hype moment. Me and Jay have not talked today. People don't realize. I just call you, like, let's go.
It was just like, okay, I just washed my hands. Yeah. Okay, what broke now? Okay, what ready? Okay.
Let's go.
That was about it.
That's about it. So, now, wait, there's nothing else. I'm not hearing much. But we'll keep you up with the latest and greatest. Jay, I'm going to make a phone call.
Okay.
Let's call Herbie.
I haven't heard from Herbie in a while.
Yeah, let's call Herbie. Hold on. I'm merging you. Can you hear me, Herbie?
Yep. Yes, I can.
Herbie, it's Steve and Jay. Man, we figure we just give you a call here. Pick your brain. We got user Q&A, but you said you just did a seminar, Steve.
It went real well. Was down at the Madison. It's actually called Wisconsin Fishing Expo, and it's really about the only show this year that I've been to. That has really shown actual growth, which was real refreshing to see. And I had a great seminar crowd and I got a little fired up about it. And I was a little burnt out here when I got back, but then you got a hold of me wanting to do this, and you guys always get me fired up, so probably fired when we up. Get done, I probably won't be able to go back to sleep.
Well, that's the hope. The whole point
was that's just, the hope.
The whole point's just to get you rattled, right? Get you mad. We were just gabbing. I was actually just complaining to Jay. I was fixing something on my trailer, but, you know, the last few weeks, been covering, Steve, some of the basic stuff, and yet last week I kind of went down this rabbit hole of patterning, right? And mistakes that people make. Quick summary, basically, you know, people fishing memories, right? They had a follow 5 years ago and they keep doing the same things the same way. And I was going to just pick your brain because you know, obviously a legend of the sport, you've been doing it for a hot moment. And plus you can get away with being as mean as you want. What are some of the most common mistakes that you see on your boat?
Well, you know, I'll be honest. The seminar that I have been doing, I actually did some last year, and I've had so many people when they heard I was or saw, you know, on social media or advertising I was going to be doing a seminar, asked me if I could redo this seminar because they liked it so much and they learned so much from it. But they weren't sure that they could got it all, you know, because I get wound up and I get off on
tangents. Yeah.
Tangents stuff, you know. So every time, really, it's a little different, regardless of what the pinpoints are, you know what I mean? It's the seminar that I did on edges, and which is basically patterning. Mm-hmm. And the thing, it's just not normal stuff. I mean, I start with the normal stuff, but, you know, like what people, I think, that make a lot, especially in this day and age, I think it's very important that I did this seminar, especially with what we're experiencing right now with the big hullabaloo about forward-facing sonar and everything else. And especially the new, younger fishermen that have come into the sport in the last year to 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
And obviously got caught right up in the scope fishing. Okay. And I mean, I'm not degrading it. I got one. Okay. But I mean, if they get, it was been so successful and so much about it and so many people, you know, talking and publicizing about big catches and all this and that with it, that some of these younger crews, I think, almost got dependent upon it to the point, and it doesn't always work. It doesn't always work all seasons and all types of lakes and so on and so forth, right? Mm-hmm. And when it doesn't, they're screwed.
Right.
Because they haven't learned the fundamentals first.
Great point,
And because no matter what, even if you're using forward-facing sonar almost exclusively, all fish relate to edges, whether... And I think what a lot of people don't realize is that, yes, a lot of edges are very noticeable and very common, mm-hmm. you know, that, you know, weed edges, rock bar edges, you know, weed lines and shorelines, stuff like that, right? But there's so many more edges, and people are so caught up in just what they've read in magazines and articles and then using forward-facing sonar that when that stuff isn't working, they're at loss. So I think all edges have within them many edges, you know what I mean? And I think people just have to be – the biggest mistake, in other words, what I see is people not being open-minded enough.
Right.
You know, and like something that I stress to people that ask me questions, because I try to be as much as a educator in the boat as trying to catch a fish, you know what I mean?
Right.
It's like, you know, I teach a person to fish, you can – you know,
I learned some new words last time I was in your boat.
but you know, I tell him, I mean, it's what makes the world go round these days. You know, the show colors, the fancy baits that come out, and it's what makes the world go round. Don't get me wrong, okay. However, I tell him, I'm going to tell you right now, the most important thing in your boat is not in your tackle box. It's what's between your ears.
Yeah, that's almost, I think that's almost how we closed the show last week, where I said, there's not a lot of physical skill in this. There is some, but to that, you know, that regard, it's a thinking man sport more so than a physical activity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, the best anglers get that, you know, but not everybody does. And then it's a changing bait syndrome type of day, you know, to find the magic deal. And there's times when certain baits definitely can, you know, hold an answer to the day in that. But more times than not, I think if you really use your head, you become multifaceted in looking for different patterns, and so on and so forth, that when you find active fish, you know, it's sometimes almost irrelevant as to the bait when you find active fish. You know what I'm saying? So
let me pick your brain on this, right? Because last week I was trying to get in one of the reasons I want to call you. The way I was trying to approach it last week on the podcast, right? When it's like the recap for Steve. Steve listens every week, but I'm just recapping. I'm teasing. Where I was going for what?
I know.
That's why I'm being a jackass. That's a joke. But what I was trying to like encapsulate or like get at was like, okay, practical applications for structure fishing, right? That's kind of like has the weekend guy or a guy that's got one trip a year or his big trip, or how does he practically apply, you know, all the crap I've got in my book, all this structure fishing stuff? So I'll put the ball in your court and go, what does a angler that is avid, they fish a little bit, they're not fishing 7 days a week like us, or they got their trip to Canada, they got a little bit of time on the water each year, how do they realistically apply, you know, the edges you're talking about, and how they apply kind of your thought process?
So are you kind of talking about with no prior information?
We're not going out blind, but we're just going out. You know, hey, perfect example. You know, they go to Andy Myers once a year and they fish their home waters in Lake Succotoban a few weekends. Yeah. You know,
there you have a big advantage because it's not a tournament at that particular lodge you mentioned, okay?
Right.
It is, and it's something that I brought to the place 35 years ago, right? And, you know, it haunts me a little bit to this day because I gave out so much information. I marked, I don't know how many thousands of maps, but I still catch my fair fish, and it made a lot of people, you know, have great trips and stuff. But, you know, there you get what's going on. So
okay, well, then take it somewhere that sucks then.
Well, what I'm getting at is no matter, even though you get that, okay, that isn't always just cast in stone. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Because not everybody has the luxury of being able to not have to catch a fish. Like the information's coming from the guides, and they sometimes, you know, aren't able to really, really explore. They got to go with what's always worked with them for them. And that's not always the case, you know. And so, like, when I talk about my structure fishing or my edges stuff, it's like, for instance, you take a weed line, okay, a nice big weed bed. Well, people, they see the edge. They read that that's, you fish the edge, and you fish up over the tops of the weeds from the edge. But what they, in this day and age, for instance, and I see it more and more all the time in the last 10, 15 years, anglers have become much more educated. They have much better tools at their advantage. And, you know, the fish are intelligently pressured even more than they've ever, ever been. So consequently, I'm finding anyway, what I see is a very big key is to be very aware of any time period or triggering type of influence as to when to be on those traditional places, because other than that, 90% of the time, the only time the particularly when you, if you're really looking for big fish, you know, they only come to classic structures under only ideal types of situations, conditions, and moon phases, and so on and so forth. So consequently, I'm trying to teach people to look for the more secondary parts of those, because within a weed bed, there's all kinds of edges. You got the secondary break with a rock mud line, and a lot of people get this mysterious vision because of what happens in Minnesota and these guys doing open water stuff over this imaginary rock mud line that is all over the open basin of the lake. What people don't realize is rock and mud edges, hard, soft bottom edges, don't have to be 30 feet deep. They can be 5 feet. They can be 5 feet. They can be 12 feet. They can be 18 feet. Depends upon the lake and its makeup, right? But those edges are still a highway. They're still a highway. They're still an edge. And fish, particularly predatory fish, follow edges. Just like big bucks follow edges of woods and fields and stuff like that, and changes in cover in the woods, difference. It's fish are the same way, you know, particularly the predatory fish. And then, so, you know, instead of, a lot of people don't feel comfortable unless they can see weeds, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I like to stay out as far away as I possibly can and still reach the edge, to fish the edge, okay, to fish the edge. Now, within that edge to the shore, there's all kinds of edges that people don't realize. You know, they don't take, they take for granted just that outside edge, because that's got to be close to deep water. You know how many big fish I've caught 3 feet of water on the inside edge?
Four.
Yeah.
Four. Okay. I thought it was a real guess. My apologies.
But, you know, so, I mean, people overlook that because they think it's snake water because it's shallow. Well, there's times, turnover times, big wind raises that water level another 2 feet or a foot and a half, because a big wind coming all the way across the lake pushing water, and it clouds that sand in between, you know, the inside weed line and shore. And then fish are in there, you know, just banging up, you know, panfish and stuff like that. Then you got different types of weeds within weeds now, particularly with all the invasive weeds, that, you know, you got your regular, you know, beautiful cabbage that was there 20 years ago. Most of it got wiped out by Eurasian milfoil and stuff like that. But there's still always pockets in most of these weed beds that there's, you know, remnants of them, maybe as big as your living room, or maybe as big as your bedroom, or maybe as big as your whole house, that have broadleaf cabbage within them. And they're hanging in on it by their toenails, trying to survive being choked out. Well, you find those patches, and those edges of that cabbage against the milfoil is unbelievable for big fish. And you know, you can find them by, obviously, the nipples, you know, but you got to mark that stuff.
By the what?
So that you can fish them at night.
Mark them by the nipples?
Yeah. Just like,
sir, on
a nice cold day, you know?
Sir, this is a Arby's. Can you just give us your order? what if find them by the nipples mean? I'm serious. Never heard that one.
Well, you know, because the little nipples that stick out of the top of the cabbage bed.
Now I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Come on, Steve. Yeah, wake up and smell the coffee.
I'm not talking
sir,
about my
sir,
girl.
Does that complete your order? just Steve Herbeck's driving around. He's hallucinating that he's on a podcast. Welcome to Arby's. May I take your order? And it's just a seminar.
So I look for a lot of that kind of stuff. And then these big, thick milfoil beds, people that got the fancy piers and houses got big, you know, trenches that go cut through right to their fancy piers with all the, you know, the pontoons and the ski boats and stuff, because they don't want to plug up their motor. But only guys I see fishing that stuff is bass fishermen.
Mm-hmm.
And those edges going, see, just like any series of structures, even any weed line edges, the more complicated it is, the more different types of things coming together, the more chance you have of muskies using it frequently, and or multiple muskies using it. So you got an outside weed line. You got the edges going in from in the channel into the boathouse. You got the inside weed line meeting that channel, and then you got both sides of that channel and the inside weed line meeting the pier. So you got all kinds of different edges there. And that's what these fish relate to, is that kind of stuff. But a lot of people don't look at it in a complex way, you know. They fish one way and that's about it, you know. So, you know, things like that, you know, I mean, that's just a very basic example of a very common structure, you know, an edge. And there's so many edges out there that people don't even, you can't even recognize, because they're not visual, you know. They're I, for a lack of different terms, I call them non-physical, just because I'm not real knowledgeable on fancy scientific terms, but they're not visual. They're just as functional. They're probably even more of a factor than some of the physical ones. But, you know, for instance, thermal climbs. People don't realize that the surface itself is such an edge that no fish can escape from. So that's the ultimate edge. People don't even think about that. They don't think about the thermal climb meeting other edges at what depth, whether it be a rock bar, point, weed edge, hard, soft bottom, thermocline edges meet. My God, that's a magnet. And people,
yeah,
people,
good people point.
People sir, don't even sir think would you like any dipping sauces, sir?
Yeah, no. So.
let me interject on you, Herbie.
Yeah.
Something you just said, and I was gabbing with a guy I talk to all the time when I'm just riffing musky ideas. And he hits me with just a little factoid about thermocline that I'd never thought about, right? So where the thermocline is, obviously we're well past the light level of light penetration, right?
Depends. A real gin clear lake, it probably right. isn't, but any lake with stain or color right. to it.
We're there.
Or green, it usually does, yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, and in general, like when you get to that drop off, even in the clear stuff, most off your open base and things of that nature. Well, with the change in density in the water, right, that it actually will change the travel of sound, right? And so at that point, where muskies can use that to predate in and out of those areas where it's going to change the transmission of vibration of sound and motion there as well. So it's kind of the ultimate edge there where, you know, a predator can utilize that in endless ways where it just becomes like this endless ambush area. Because,
well,
I mean,
and I don't think people understand just how much more complex the muskie is. You know, oh, they got mm-hmm. brain size P. Well, I've seen them do some pretty crazy things which seem to be learned behavior. You uh-huh. know what I mean? So I think, you know, their whole makeup, you know, they're kind of like, you know, a great white. They're the master predator, you know. They got more things going than even other predators, you know, just because they have to, you know what I mean? And you know, so, yeah, I can see their in tune with that. What a lot of people don't realize too is that muskies can actually track a fish in the water. Mm-hmm. I've learned this from the guys at Berkeley when they were trying to make scent. Mm-hmm. You know, back in the days when that was a big thing. Well, they couldn't really come up with it. They did, but it was just a sales job. Right. As far as Northerns, they used scent a lot. But the muskies, not so much. And what they do is they use, and I think it, if I'm not mistaken, I think it had something to do with all the holes in the bottom of their jaws. Uh-huh. I think that was a major factor in it. But like they said that, like say a sucker swam through the water, and a muskie oof pops up. I'm going on a walkabout. I'm on a hunt, and it starts zigzagging through, looking for these trails that these fish make. And what it is as a fish moves through the water, it disrupts the molecules of the water, kind of like, I don't know how best to explain it.
Like a calm trail you see coming off of a plane.
Yeah, and as they move through the water, it disrupts the molecules in a way that and it stays before they all settle and come all back together. I guess it's up to about 20 minutes. That muskie can hit that disturbed molecule trail and follow the bait fish right to it and take it.
Weird.
That's pretty heavy shit. Huh. You know, that's pretty heavy shit.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, if they want to hunt it down, they can. I mean, it's definitely
most of the time they don't have to. Most right. of the time it's almost for them to feed. If you watch them in the big aquariums at Bass Pros and other places, when they go on to feed, it's almost effortless. You know, I mean, it's they don't get big and fat because they got to work hard at it. You know what I mean?
Not at all. Let me ask you this, just to simplify it, right? Where let's take the surface. You said, you know, one of the most dominant edges. Couldn't agree more with you. The surface, right?
Yep.
How do you take that concept to, again, very basic, take that to the most fundamental, break it down to the most simplest ways where someone that is a, you know, beginning avid musky angler could apply that thought? So what is the basis of that thought that somebody could kind of start using in a real world application?
Well, for one thing, muskies are aware of the surface at all times. And I don't care. I don't know how deep this goes, but I'm sure pretty damn deep. Okay. Mm-hmm. They're always aware of what's going on the surface. Okay. Because of, you know, splashes and fish being chased by other fish and fish injured flopping and so on, birds attacking birds attacking bait fish and stuff like that. They are, and basically all real pelagic type of game fish are that way. So, you know, I don't really worry about when I'm casting, unless I'm in very shallow, clear water and the fish are really spooky or something like that because of that. Like, say, in the early spring, fishing warming water in marinas or shallow bays, you know, stuff like that. Those fish can be very spooky no matter what. But once things are up and at them and fish are, you know, feeding regularly, normally, and stuff like that through the season, I don't even worry about making splashes loud with my baits. As a matter of fact, I think sometimes it's advantageous, too. You know what I'm saying? That it wakes fish up, makes them alert to a situation of perhaps a feeding up, an easy feeding opportunity, you know? So, I think that's one way I look at it. And then, I mean, even out over open basins that have cisco-based or shad-based populations that come up in the evenings and start flipping as they're, you know, eating bugs or zooplankton or whatever. I mean, do not think that there aren't big fish nearby if there's, you know, a sizable population of predators and in the lake. And now you have a very easy situation of these bait fish right on the surface, where now, you know, it's hardly a horizontal chase deal. It's just pinning them against the surface and it's over. You know what I'm saying? I've caught fish on zigzag topwaters over 50 feet of water in the late evening, you know, over big schools. So, you know, I think that's one way. You know, I think another way to think about it is weed beds that come right to the surface. You know, very hard to fish, you know, unless you're fishing pockets. Unless you're fishing these channels like I talked about, or you're fishing pockets. And there can be pockets within the thickest weeds. And the reason there's a pocket is usually because there's something very abnormal on the bottom there for that stretch of...
there's a rock, sort of, there's a...
Yeah, there's rocks or springs or something that keep the weeds from...
Dead body.
From, right. So, but other than that, when you get a big wind especially, those weeds lay over a little bit.
Yes.
And plus you have the wind pushing water that can add 6 inches to a foot, depending on how far the lake is the wind is pushing the water, you know, and you're not even talking about along the edges within these places we talked about of current, you know, from the wind, but I'm just talking about creating now a feeding lane between the top of the weeds and the surface. And then them fish get up and they start cruising over the top. And when they're doing that, they're very, very catchable. And that's usually under dark, cloudy, windy, nasty conditions, you know, and after dark, you know what I mean? So that edge is, that's, you know, like when topwaters and stuff like that, bulging bucktails and things like that are just funner than hell, you know?
I think conceptually, and tell me if, and literally, if I'm wrong, tell me I'm wrong. Just this is the way I've thought about. Because, let me back that up. Like when you're talking about edges and you're talking about a lot, I think you and I are lines of thinking cross one another quite a bit, right? Whether you call it structure fishing or you call it edges, it doesn't matter, right? It's the leading in, it's the interconnectivity of the subsurface world both ways, right? But when I think of this surface edge, right? When I'm thinking of the edge as a surface, I'm looking at it from the sense that, let's say structurally or edge-wise, however you want to look at it, that muskies will position in such a way that they're going to drive, whether the bait fish are very at the surface is immaterial, that they intend to pin their targets to the surface because once fish hit air, they can't go anywhere. Is that the way you're looking?
In freshwater, anyway, we don't have flying fish.
Well,
they can give it a try, but it don't.
Not
it don't
long. Last they can fly long. Very, very short. I mean, is that the way, like, mentally you're looking at it, where you're going, okay, they're using this of, as just as you're going to drive. Maybe they're going to drive the bait fish over the weeds, and they know that they can't go anywhere, you know, and the same with the bottom.
Yeah, I don't know if they drive them over. I think they can push, you know, because of the bait fish panic, they can push them to the surface, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, a bait fish panic will do anything to get away from a muskie, you know. But then once they're within that range of the surface, the muskie knows it's got them. You know what I mean?
Right.
There's, you know, it's an easy deal, you know. And not only muskies, but walleyes do the same thing on the open water. You know, a lot of fish do start white, stripers do it, and stripers and light bass and stuff do it like incredibly, mm-hmm. you know, to where that's a pattern. And, like my brother guides stripers down in Texas, and I mean, they just drive around looking for birds, kind of like they do on the ocean, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, looking for commotion on the surface.
Five birds crashing, and I haven't seen that so much in freshwater muskie fishing, but what I've done a lot is I've made big notice of where the flocks of seagulls are sitting over open water all day. And when not necessarily, they're not diving, they're not, you know, trying to get, they're sitting because they know that down below in that 35-60 feet.
Stop. The first time we talked about edges like years ago on the podcast, we got like 3 million emails, right? Me and you were like, okay, we're not going to bring it. Just stop. Don't give that one away. Dude,
don't give away flock of seagulls?
No, he's never. You've never talked to me. We've never talked about that, but I know where you're going, and it's so ridiculously good. So listen up, everybody. I didn't know you knew this, Steve, because I know this, but go ahead.
I know everything.
Sorry, but you don't know you're at an Arby's drive through. But anyway.
No.
Okay, but explain.
I mean, you know, let's go back to the basic question that was you were making. That was the basic, you know, what I see mistakes people make mostly. And that is, like I said, the most major one. The one that can make the biggest impact in how they progress and grow as fishermen is whether they have, and not all, that's what makes guys that start and then in short time, all of a sudden they're awesome anglers. You know what I'm saying? It's because they have that ability to open their mind up and be creative and think about things that why is, all, you know, with people that think why, how, and where. Whenever something happens or when it isn't happening, are those people that put stuff together. And not all people can have that. Just like I can't play a guitar like you can. You know what I mean? I don't have that. I just don't have that conception, like, right. You know, of a musician. It's the same way when it comes to fishing. You know what I mean? So that's one major thing that I see.
Hold on, before you move on, you're going to have to cover the birds. I wasn't really trying to cut you off because people will get mad about that. But I did want to ask you first, though, right, because you do have massive ADD like me. So do you have any recommendations on how to open your mind?
Moving on. Depends on if you have a druggist for a friend, I guess.
Okay. Explain the freaking. And guys, this is all one elongated promo for Steve Herbeck's peyote tablets, now available at the Muskie Shop. If it's not a Herbeck peyote, it's not the real deal.
I don't know. I think you either got it or you don't, unfortunately.
Explain the birds.
And I have seen in some instances huge flocks of loons migrating along with mergansers and seagulls and stuff beating up on bait fish schools. And you don't want to, anytime you see that or you see bait fish actually turns or seagulls actually diving, it takes, you know, there are bait fish there, okay, for sure. And there's probably some type of predator nearby, you know what I mean, whether it be muskies, pike, or walleyes or some. But what a lot of people do is they make the mistake of running into the school and screwing it all up, okay. If the bait fish are in that school already, at least when it comes to more singular or small pod type of fish like muskies, they're probably almost non-catchable because they've already foraged real heavy. What I tend to do is fish around them, looking for fish that are coming to them, because they hear that disturbance. They hear that what a feel, not necessarily hear, but they feel and sense what's going on hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of yards away, maybe even miles, I don't know, but long distances away, and come to these disturbances. You know what I'm saying? So I feel the ones that you got the best chance to catch is on the outside of the schools that haven't gotten there yet or are still just thinking you're shepherding that school and thinking maybe it's about time to put on the feed bag. Those are the ones that you catch, mm-hmm. You know. Now, if they're scattered bait fish and there isn't pods all real tight, well, then I'll troll all through everything, because what real tight bait fish schools tell me is that they're scared shitless. Mm-hmm. You know, the one in the center doesn't want to be on the one on the outside. The one on the outside wants to be the one in the middle. That's why they're so tightly packed, right? Mm-hmm. There's predators nearby, whether it be the birds, whether it be, you know, muskies and walleyes and bass or whatever, you know, that. But anyway, what I was getting to is when it comes to muskies and the lakes that I see this happen on, which is mostly on the Canadian Shield lakes. I've seen it on some of your bigger lakes up north, like some on the Flambeau chain with big populations of smelt and ciscos and stuff like that, and trout lake, places like that got huge populations, is that the ciscos in that usually don't come up unless towards evening. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That's when the daffia comes up, and they rise up above the thermoclines for a short time, feeding on these rising daffia, and then around a little bit after dark, they go back down. But the areas can be pretty huge, and it's not everywhere. So if there are flocks of seagulls out there, and they're just sitting, this flock, maybe 10, 12, maybe 30, 40, but they're just sitting out on the middle of the lake, people don't look at them in anything other than a bunch of seagulls swimming around. Those seagulls know that there's big bait fish schools down below them. They know they're there, and they're waiting for them to come up.
Yep.
And that is the area to concentrate on, or to look at. That is an option to consider, you know, later on in the day when these bait fish schools come up. You know, if you're fishing trout or if you're fishing walleyes that can be deeper, yes, you could troll deeper using lead core or snap weights or, you know, deep divers, depending upon the time of the year, how deep these bait fish are, and maybe even with muskies, but I've usually left it alone until they're coming up. You know what I mean? Right.
Yeah, you nailed it. I look for that at times, whether it be eagle or any big body of water, because people just blow by that, and here's 40, 50 seagulls or whatever, just kind of, they're there. You know, it took me a while to realize. I go, and you know, embarrassingly so, I drive by, okay, there's always kind of, the seagulls are always kind of there, right? Yeah. Well, no, they're honed in because they're, like you said, later in the day, whether it be, you know, walleye or whatever's driving that bait fish up and things start coming up, they're waiting from, they're death from above, waiting on death from below to do the job for them.
Right.
And it's kind of like that movement of, okay, here's the birds, here's the walleye, here's the Lakers, whatever, something's going to move that forage. And I didn't even know you kind of honed in on that, because that's kind of always been an ace up my sleeve.
This is something that's really crazy, okay? You know, then some of the things over the last 40 years I've come upon have been really crazy to start with. You know what I mean? Okay, so everybody's worried about sound scaring fish and all this and that, right? Well, my brother guides down in Texas, and it's white bass, big white bass, wipers and stripers, right?
Yep.
These crazy, every good guide down there, okay, they make a thumper out of windshield wipers that they put into a compartment, one of their storage compartments in their boat, and it's going thump, 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 thump all day. And then they have a, a, pole in the boat, and they're going boom, 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 and the shad will bunch mm-hmm. up too, but the white bass and the wipers and the stripers all just come and start concentrating down below the boat, and the only thing people can think of is it is that relation between the birds and the bait, that it sounds something like bait fish being beat up on the surface or something, and that's what draws these stripers and let's face it, I don't think stripers and white bass are on the same league as muskies when it comes to, you know, evolutionary whatever they got going, you know. But, you know, I don't know. It goes to the point of, you know, this the EBS stuff too. You know what I mean? We're only I always say we're when it comes to really working with sounds and fleeing baitfish sounds and the stumping sounds, which is a crude form of baitfish sounds, I guess, you know, mm-hmm. or fish being preyed upon. I always like compare it to like going to the moon and Christopher Columbus coming to America, and right now we're Christopher Columbus. You know, so who knows what's in store, you know? What do we really know? Nobody's really explored that part or experimented enough that I know of when it comes to muskies. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, look at there's natives and stuff all over Asia or whatever that do weird shit on shorelines and bring whole schools of fish right to shore and they spear them and nut them. You know, so they're, you know, and these are predatory fish, you know. So I don't know. There might be something there. You know, now we're starting to get whacked out, you know, on where we were going from.
We've been whacked out, buddy. We've been whacked out. Well, I mean, you say that. I was just, while you were talking, I was trying to look on the old internet box here. Last time I was in Hungary with Eric, there was this dude, and he had the stick, right? It kind of looks like a curved hatchet handle that has this plopper for hitting the water on the side of your boat to call up whales, catfish.
Right? Oh, yeah.
It just makes that sound of, you know, that really bassy, deep sound. And they swear by it. Like, literally, the guy just sits there in the boat all day just hammering the water.
When I fish with my brother, by the end of the day, I got a goddamn migraine, man. I'm looking for Advils, you know?
You know, for get you some earplugs. I would just come, you know, knowing me, I'll come up with a machine that just does it. You know, just beating the water there. You know,
that's just an example. I don't know where it could go or if there's anything there. But that's just an example of being open-minded and thinking about stuff. Like, you know, I mean, you know, my quickset rigs that I designed 35 years ago or more, I mean, they came off of a kind of an offshoot of watching, you know, deep sea fishermen fishing. Me and my boy were out with tuna guys and stuff, and the bridle that they use on bonitas and stuff for marlin and stuff. And I adapted it to a rubber band that could break free. You know, mm-hmm. rather, they don't care. Marlin don't care about, you know, care. They eat the whole thing in a second. You know what right. I mean? But when it came to so, you know, just being aware of, and there's a lot of things that, you know, just being open-minded can get you, you know, get you in a groove, you know, or at least keep you so alert that you're more aware of even just the normal things of what's going on.
I think you're with saying that, like, kind of, okay, so if you're being open-minded and you're being aware, right, so we're being observant, we're willing to change. I think a lot of people, the never-ending struggle, they got to cast their arms off and they won't put down the bucktails, they won't break away from what's already worked of, like, what I'm trying to articulate, I guess, in some capacities, I think you and I both will just do dumb shit to see if it'll work, and then you're pleasantly surprised sometimes. I mean, how many times have you done that, Steve? You just do something like, nobody does this or nobody's thought of doing this, and then bam, fish start hitting the net. Is that kind of like your thought process or how?
I mean, it doesn't work all the time, but once in a while you hit on something. Same way with fishing spots. You know, so many people get caught on getting their map marked, and all they do is fish community spots.
Right.
You know, I mean, I try to fish a couple of new spots every day that I don't see people fishing, but to me, look like they could hold it. They don't all work out.
Right.
But I'll tell you right now, there's probably half of the spots between Western Arm to Coleman Reef, anyway, in that whole area, the whole central part of the lake, and down into Meridian and those bays there that there's a lot of spots that were never being fished 40 years ago and are now.
Yeah.
Because a lot of innovative anglers that were at Andy Myers Lodge through the wool muskie hunts and stuff like that we put on. And we just all made it a point every night to compare notes and see what was working. And you know, and I think another thing people really screw up on is not realizing how much current makes a difference, even in lakes that don't have inlets and outlets.
Yeah.
You know,
wind-related current is so
incredibly important that people just don't, a lot of people, well, they do now, it's real good anglers, but a lot of your beginning anglers don't, you know what I mean? Even if they read about it, they still don't think about it or really, like a lot of times, if I know that we're through a windy stretch, I sit up at night before the next day or even early in the morning, and I get the weather report on the wind directions, and I pour over the map, and I look where the wind will be pushing water through narrower areas and between islands and between narrows, even between rock bars out in the middle of the lake that are down 10, 12, 15 feet. There's still a narrows created there. People don't understand that kind of stuff. And that's how I set up a lot of times my daily game plan, because more times than not, when you have current moving any type through any type of constricting area or something like that, you have feeding fish.
So that is, I mean, something we bang on here all the time, but the operative thing of what you just said, and to radiate from people here, is you're conceptualizing what's taking place before you hit the water.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And that I think that's so, heck, I mean, in the book and Next Level Musky Fishing, I actually talk about you doing that, and that's something, you know, that you're thinking ahead, or you know the lake well enough, which, you know, point A being you better know the lake, you better know your cardinal directions, you better have understanding of what's happening, right, before you can play that game. But that, Steve, like when you're conceptualizing how weather is affecting a body of water, right, and you've done your map study, your conceptualization the night before, correct me if I'm wrong, you're also conceptualizing your approach, your drift speed, and your boat control in relation to that. So you're not fishing areas the same because the wind and the positioning is different every time, correct?
Well, the boat control and stuff kind of just goes with what you come up against, you know, when you're
right, racing. Right. But you're not, what I'm getting at is you're not going, okay, the wind's blowing different on this rock bar, but I fish it the same way. You're making adjustments for the climactic changes in your approach.
Oh, for sure. Because, you know, too, and that's why, you know, your mapping and stuff, you're setting waypoints. Like, I got thousands of waypoints, but they're not just all on spots. They're on spots, but they're, you know, around every, like say a rock bar, I'll have every inside turn with a waypoint, every finger that sticks out. And so when you got currents moving a certain direction, and you got rock bars or points or even reed beds that got turns and inside turns and points and cups and stuff, that's where you visualize how that current hits those turns and points and curves and stuff and creates eddies and stuff and where the feeding fish will actually be setting up.
Yeah.
You know?
Let me pick your brain on this, right? On the conceptual.
Instead of a 5-mile weed line that you can probably fish, you know, along that weed line, because of the direction of the wind and the current that it's created, which waypoints to spend a little bit more time tucking in and out of them.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Let me ask you this. So We're conceptualizing climactic effects. We're conceptualizing to find the spot on spots or the most likely areas on areas, right?
Yeah.
Talk about, I know you do it, you've not told me you do it, I'll be shocked if you don't. Conceptualize, explain to me how you conceptualize the action of a bait in its interaction subsurface with structure and cover. What are you thinking about? How a bait's running underwater, you know, how does that influence your lure choice, and how does that influence how you're articulating a bait? Like the way, because your conception...
It's starting to get pretty goddamn complicated sentences put together for this boy.
that's bullshit. You've done the same thing I've done. I hide behind being a hillbilly, and you just hide behind being, I don't know nothing. Bullshit. You know exactly what I'm saying. How are you? What are you doing? Are you like, let's say, for example, you're throwing at Alien, right? And if you don't know, Alien is a very kind of known place in Canada on Eagle Lake.
Basically, my lure choice, first of all, has to do with, you know, a basic understanding of years of fishing of what has been working. You know, that's my starting point. Now,
right.
Now, second part of that choice is how shallow do I have to be with the bait, and then how deep can I be with the bait along that same retrieve? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
What are the fish doing? Are they really aggressive? Are they really chasing? Are they very inactive? Is the water temperature dropped 4 or 5 degrees, or is it on an upswing and everything's happening? You know, those are all things that go into making your lure choices. You know what I mean? And I'll tell you, I got 3 boxes of baits in my boat, mm-hmm. and I got the same 12 baits sitting on the shelf of my boat that I've used about 90% of the time because they cover that range, you know what I mean?
Yeah, they're covering the different water call. Yep.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
So, you know, that gets around it. I mean, what you're saying is, and I love it because you could throw, you know, you go with a bucktail, right? Everybody's got them. Everybody throws them.
Yeah.
You throw a bucktail. You could be throwing over active fish, but you're not closing. I call it the proximity gap, right? There's a varying degree of how close you have to get to one before they'll react, right?
And that's generally according to how active they are.
Right.
You know, how clear the water is, how active they are. You know, I mean, active fish in clear water will travel a lot farther than fish in dark water and inactive fish. You know what I'm saying? If inactive fish, you got to be closer to them regardless, no matter if it's clear or dark water, but it's still farther in clear water than it is in dark water, I feel. So that goes back to my old saying, you know, clear water fish are cheetahs and dark water fish are leopards, you know, they're ambushers. Clear water fish are cheetahs, they run it down. But you know, I think, you know, real inactive fish, you might have to have that bait within a foot or 2 feet before they even move, and maybe several times.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And in different angles, and yep.
Yeah, and yet you got an active fish, and they'll get, you know, down near, you know, bear traumatize themselves from 30 feet of water flying up after a bucktail 5 feet down. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Because it just depends on how wound up they are. You know what I mean?
Absolutely, and I mean, like you're saying, that dictates your lure selection on any given day. I mean, let me ask you this, just for the benefit of everybody here. You're sitting there, I don't care what body of water on, you're doing I guess I didn't know you had a routine. I guess any good guide does. I kind of have my routine and what I'm looking at. So you're going through all the factors that matter to you, right?
Okay, so here too. This is something, like, I'm trying to keep things... You know, I try to keep things, even though you can't, but you try within complexity, you try to keep it as simple as possible. Right. So, you know, as long as I'm using a bait that covers the water column or the structure that I'm fishing efficiently, my old saying is, it's really funny how you end up catching fish with what's on the end of your line.
Yes, sir. There you go. Yeah. That does not help our corporate overlords, but other than that, yeah. I better get that new collar, though. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. My thing is, if a bait's good, if it, I don't judge a bait by what the, I mean, obviously there's a lot of intricacies with a bait, but
yeah.
I select a bait going what most contours the cover and structure that I'm fishing as tightly as possible. And it either has a sink rate or a float up that I can use to my advantage. That's it. Right.
Yeah, so it's like, don't get me wrong. My boy gives me a call and says, Jesus, they're really hot on this. Don't think I ain't going to clip one
off. I remember a couple years ago, he said, Danny's whacking them on white beavers. I'm in the musky shop grabbing crap for me and you. I'm like, oh, I'm taking that white beaver. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But with that being said, you know, most of the time it's yeah, who doesn't love that? But most of the time, you know, it boils down to that contour and cover and structure where, you know, you're a big proponent of the pounder from Livingston, right? And you know, undeniably it resembles other crankbaits. But like the choice for me between like a jointed depth rater and the pounder from Livingston is, okay, am I taking advantage of that slower right of raise or the running depth of the pounder versus the greater buoyancy of the depth rater, which can make the difference? You know, and that
similar looks don't mean they're the same.
No,
you know what I mean?
It's like women.
Yeah, you know, exactly, man. You know, they can look the same, you know, body wise, but there's one that's a lot wilder.
I usually just find the crazier one.
Yeah. So I mean, you know, the thing about the pounder is it suspends, which is nice. If I'm trolling and I can make turns, it doesn't rise up into my rest of my spread. If I'm making tight turns, if I have to make real tight turns to get around, get back to some bait fish or something. You know, there's a slightly a deeper angle in the lip, so, you know, it has a crazier, wider wobble. You can see in the joints how the joints are all wore from clicking against each other. You know, and it's got EBS. So, there are, you know, regardless, don't get me wrong, I got hundreds of depth raters in my arsenal, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Got a lot of sound. But, you know, everything is different. And, you know, even though, and there's how many baits like a phantom are there? I mean, you know what I mean? But just some work a little different, some work a little better, some don't work as good, mm-hmm. you know? But, you know, everything can be different, you know? So, yeah, I know, but I love those baits there. I love the Striker too. I mean, it suspends, so I mean, I can make it do all kinds of things that you can't do with a bait that floats after you rip it and jerk it. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
I think a lot of that is making that selection, that buoyancy selection, or that running depth selection based on action. I mean, sometimes you got to check them both. You know, I mean.
Well, if I'm fishing shallow weeds or something, I'm going to want a bait that backs back up, that floats back up.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
You need, yeah,
so,
yeah.
It's all the situation. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, I was saying a few moments ago, we got sidetracked. You're sitting around, you're doing your pontification before a trip, right? Before you're,
there you go. There's another big word that I don't. I'm gonna have to get Webster on.
Oh yeah, says the man that says I know everything earlier. So
that was a joke. That was a joke.
Well, yeah. Uh-huh. Well,
that's my old lady.
Yeah. So you're sitting around. You're thinking about what your game plan is tomorrow. What's I know everything matters. But what's the hierarchy? What's the most important thing that you're looking at? So what's the top three considerations for you planning your day?
One, what section of the lake or type of lake or a lake that I've either had a lot of success in the past under the conditions that were experienced, like time of the year, sunlight, wind, whatever. I just take those or whatever information I can get from somebody. That gives me a starting point, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Then I look at the weather and I try to determine what type of, you know, what are the water temps and the weather and what do I think, what's the activity level of the fish probably going to be, at least to give me a start. Sometimes it isn't what you hope it will be. Nobody can always predict it. Fish are fish, right?
Right.
Yeah. You know, and so those are, and then I look at the map and try and put some game plan together. Do I vary my game plan? Oh, most definitely a lot. But I'll usually, it's kind of like a football team and their initial game plan and what they go through the first few series, you know, to see if this is what's going to be working against an opposing team. And it's kind of the way I set things up and then go from there.
Yeah, adjust to what you're
saying. If you can have a, buddies or friends or like me, case where I'm up on Eagle, me and my boy, we do a lot of referring back and forth through the course of the day, and we don't get in on anybody's stuff, but we use what's working for us if what's working for the other guy isn't, too, because we know the lake so well, we can adapt it to similar situations in other parts of the lake that we invariably are anyway, because the last thing either one of us wants to do is I don't want to be behind him, and he sure as hell don't want to be behind me.
Sounds like a challenge. Speaking of Danny, I bothered him earlier today. I was talking to him about reels, you know, and he was trying to get his hands on a new setup here, and we were talking about what, you know, just between he and I, what we preferred. I think you kind of fall in the same school of thought there. But are you fishing, Steve, 5.3? What's your gear ratio?
I got one reel that's, you know, a 6, I don't know what it is, 6.2, 6.4, whatever. That, when you're over 6, the first one.
Yeah, 6.3.
Yeah, 6.3. I got one reel of those that I got on a short stiff rod that I use for, you know, snapping jerk baits and zigzag top waters and stuff like that. But for the most part, I like 5.4s filled right to the top.
Yep.
And if they're filled, 5.4s are filled right to the top, you know, and they got a good power handle on them. I like to reel fast. It gets me excited. It makes me hyped up.
That's cool.
Rather than just reel slow against the hard pull. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I never liked riding my bike up a 10-speed up a hill in low gear either. You know what I mean? Or in high gear. So, I mean, you know, it's kind of like that. So, and 5.4 with half the spool, yeah, that's too slow. But a 5.4 full, right to the top, with a power handle, and you're a nervous cat like I am when I'm fishing, I think it's as fast as I need to be most of the time. And if it's not, then I give the guys in the front of the boat that got the 6s and 7s and 8s pull those baits, and they can, you know, they can have the sore muscles at the end of the day.
Yeah, that's it. I hadn't asked, and it's probably one of the most common things I see between guys that catch a bunch of fish versus the guys that don't, are slow gear ratio reels. You know, I called it years ago where, you know, we first got these low profile super reels, right? Everything was 6.3:1 and then higher. And you watch these guys, they buy these new reels and they're not catching fish, you know, and being a lefty, I was kind of left in the dirt there for a minute where I was still fishing round reels, you know, your Calcuttas and your Abus. And I kind of looked at it from the aspect of going, the most of the time, these fast reels are killing people. They're killing how many fish they're catching.
Yeah. I mean, there's times when guys, I mean, I'll have a guy with a fast reel up in the front of the boat, you know, throwing, a number 5 or willow leaf, number 5 French or willow leaf you know, 7 or 8 Colorado fast. You know, for the first bait through, especially warmer water conditions and over shallower structure, and it really pays off. But, you know, I'm going to tell you honestly, most of the, at least in the waters I fish, and I know it changes from lake to lake and and people could, you know, and you catch, no matter what, people could say what works and what doesn't, but, mm-hmm. you know, usually you catch fish, like, just like the bait on the end of your line with what you're doing, you know, whether, could you catch more, you know, doing it some other way? You don't know because you catch them doing it the way you're doing it, you know what I mean? So, for the most part, most of the real big fish that I've caught, not necessarily have been slow, because that induces too many follows. But as fast as I want to work something with a full 5-4, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? Versus working something so fast with a 7 or 8, you know, reel that, you know, I catch, you probably sometimes you can catch more fish doing that, but I don't. And the same way with trolling speeds. I don't catch a lot of really, my big fish trolling really fast. Yeah. You know, mostly mid-3s and mid-3s and below. And, you know, if I get up over 4.5, you know, stuff like that, there's sometimes when the water's warm, I'll catch more fish, but I don't necessarily catch that many of the big ones. At least, and maybe I'm a victim of what I've just said, and that's the way I do it. But yeah. I experiment. I always experiment, you know what I mean? So, but it's just too, it's tougher when you got one line and, you know, you don't know, should I change baits, should I change the speed? Because sometimes you might only get several bites, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? And then, you know, and they may only come during certain short periods of windows during the day. So, you know, it's the game. It's what makes it the game, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, back to the crazy talk, right? It's not your average musky podcast here, Steve. We're into the more metaphysical. There's another decent word for you, right? Conceptualization, if you will.
Let me look it up.
He's thumbing through. He's going over to what they call the internet at his house. It's an old set of Encyclopedia Britannica he bought door to door.
Let me
thumbing through here. Sir, this is an Arby's. But when you're on the boat and you're guiding, right? You're standing there, and this is the way I feel when you tell me how, you know, experience is different. But a lot of times I'm sitting here, my mouth is moving, right? And my brain's going a different direction. Most of the time. My mouth, it never shuts. But now, freaking show him what he's won. You know, I'm sitting here trying to hang with the clients there, and we're talking, and my brain's always going in a different direction. Like, what can we be doing? When do we need to make a change? What do I need to put on this guy's rod? What changes do we need to make? Right. And I feel like I tend to kind of beat the horse to death a little bit before I make a change. Right.
Yeah.
With you, I know you're thinking ahead. You gotta be, there's no way you're not. So you're going through the same crap, I'm betting. You know, you're listening to some story about Johnny saw a muskie eat a beaver, and you're trying to figure out what the game plan is. How mm-hmm. long are you adhering to that plan? Are you making adjustments with the clients? Are you like, where are you at in that moment? Okay, you don't know what the hell's going on. You haven't seen a fish yet. You got the pressure on you. You know, you got the weight of the world on your shoulders in the back of your head. What do you do? Like, how quick are you making a change? What kind of adjustments are you making in that moment?
Well, you know, I'll usually give it some time because, see, you know, if you're not seeing nothing, you're usually under, you know, more than likely you're talking about, you know, at least having a real good basic understanding of what has been working. Mm-hmm. And that's what you start with. It's not like you just, you know, you know, got a Zebco, and this is the first time I'm putting the nuts on. You got an idea, right?
Right.
So, you know, if you're going through your first couple series of good spots that you know that they should be using because they have been through the week or, you know, and stuff like that, and it's not happening, well, then you got to kind of consider that, okay, something's going on, okay? Something's going on that affected what's happened. You
right.
know what I mean? It's just not moving. Okay. So then you have to make the determination. Should I switch patterns? Which usually aren't hard to do on a lake like Eagle or some of the lakes in northern Wisconsin. Even a lake change in northern Wisconsin can be magic. Mm-hmm. Then that it's almost like changing patterns, you know, because you can have a lake quarter mile down the road from one are totally different than the other. And I've seen lakes, I've switched 3, 4, 5 times in a day, finally found active fish. But where I was getting to before was, you know, okay, so it's probably something, is at least where you're at, something's not happening. Doesn't take much to go on your way to the same type next spot, which is the same pattern that you think should be working, quickly stopping and trying something else quickly, you know. Mm-hmm. But you have to figure that what has been working and it isn't working could be just the fact that you're going to have a short window, and you better watch your moon phases, you better watch the weather and stuff like that, because you may only have just a short window. You may just have a short bite, and it may not be till right before dark that day. You know what I mean? So, and that's what makes muskie fishing what it is, you know, is that, you know, unfortunately we go through some good stretches where the fish are biting really good and like crazy, and then, you know, we go through some stretches where they're tougher hell, and then you got stretches where it goes up and down. You got to kind of roll with the punches. You know, it's nice to have, you know, somebody else too that's on your, that's in your, you know, your line of contact, that, you know, maybe is fishing a different pattern or different parts of the lake, and you can pair notes during the day. That's, I'll tell you honestly, that is invaluable if you can do more. You know, and it's a like-minded fisherman, you know, or guide, you know, and stuff. So, but yeah, even when things are working that I think should be working, I still fish other patterns in between spots. You know what I'm saying? So, you just don't know what you're going to stumble up upon, and you know, you just got to keep, like I said, that part of that's being open-minded, not be closed-minded and thinking there's only one pattern that could be working, or one bait that could be working, or, you know, so on and so forth. So,
heck yeah. My goodness. I just looked at, man, we've been rambling forever, Steve.
Yeah, well, I'm getting tired too. So
I'm sorry. I could go forever just prattling along here. But anyway, do you have any more seminars?
My wife's looking out the bedroom window with a wink in her eye too, so I'm going to be going pretty soon.
I hear you. Well, what are you doing, any more seminars coming up?
Yeah. I got to look at my calendar. I can't remember.
Just guess.
I got one in Elspeth, Illinois, with the Muskie Club down there, coming up in March. We got the big Madison Chapter Muskie School that one March 22nd, which is, God, if you can, guys can get to that want to learn, it's unbelievable. There's like, I don't know how many seminars they got going on in the course of the day, and you sign up for which ones you want, and the price is very nominal, and all the proceeds go to stocking and improving the lakes and stuff. It's all some of the best guys around that are supporting it.
Nice.
That's a real win-win situation there. Yeah. Let's see. Then I got the one in Illinois, Elsip, Illinois Muskie Club there. Can't remember what they call them. Midwest Muskie Club, I think.
This is the best promo I've ever heard. Come on down, folks. I'm going to be talking some. Listen, folks, this is Steve Herbeck. I'm going to be talking somewhere. It's some muskie club in Illinois. If you can get there, come on out. It's going to be a hell of a time.
So, yeah, I'll have it on my Facebook.
Kirby just rolls out and he says, "Hello, Cleveland,
sir." Yeah, yeah. Once well, again,
I mean, it
sir,
usually
this,
works.
Sir, yeah, this is
that
the,
usually works.
Sir, you're in an Arby's in Janesville. Could you please put the baits down? There's people trying to eat. Okay. Anyway, guys, keep up with Herbie on social. Well, here shortly, we're going to get on here and gab about some of the baits, but crawled down the rabbit hole here. All right, everybody, say goodnight.
Yep, take care. If they want to get a hold of me about anything, just, you know, look up on my website, Steve Herbeck Fishing, all the contact information's there. I got a few, maybe 3 or 4 days left in May in southern Wisconsin. I got 1 or 2 days left up in Vilas County, 1 day, I think, in June. A couple first part of September after I get back from Canada. And nothing in November. November's full. I got a couple days after Friday after Thanksgiving to the 15th of December on Big Green. So I'm just about getting full, but, you know, give me a call to see if we can make something work.
There you go. Give him a holler, boys. We'll talk to you soon. Jaybird, say goodnight.
Night, guys. Thanks, Herbie.
Later. Yep.
I can't get these muskies out of my mind, and some kind of madness has started to evolve. Yeah, and I tried so hard to let you go, but a big monster